Today is Tuesday, January 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, China says a coronavirus that originated in Wuhan can be transmitted human to human.
New virus from the family of coronaviruses. Coronaviruses normally circulate in the animal world, and then we'll jump to the human population, as it was the case with the SARS in 2002.
Plus, what's been the impact on businesses in Australia as brush fires continue to burn and tens of thousands of U.S. gun rights activists meet in the Virginia state capitol? Those stories and more are next. The head of a Chinese government expert team said Monday that human-to-human transmission has been confirmed in an outbreak of a new coronavirus, a development that raises the possibility that it could spread more quickly and widely. Chinese President Xi Jinping called on the government to take every possible step to combat the outbreak. The outbreak began in the Chinese city of Wuhan, spread to the capital Beijing and Shanghai. National and local authorities confirmed on Monday. South Korea on Monday also confirmed its first case, a 35-year-old Chinese national who had traveled from Wuhan. Two cases have also been reported in Thailand and one in Japan. All involved people from Wuhan or recently visited the city. There are now at least 220 confirmed cases worldwide and three deaths. Authorities around the globe, including the United States and many Asian countries, have stepped up screening of travelers from Wuhan. It's not clear yet how the virus spreads. It is in the same family as the virus that caused the severe acute respiratory syndrome, a deadly disease that killed more than 800 people, most of them in Hong Kong and southern China in 2003. To learn more about the outbreak, International Edition's Jason Patinkin spoke with World Health Organization spokesman Tarek Tsarevic in Geneva, Switzerland.
Well, we have seen the increasing number of confirmed cases in the past couple of days. And this is because the Chinese authority have increased the surveillance and testing for new coronavirus. So basically, we are now seeing more people being confirmed as countries increase the surveillance. That's a good sign. At the same time, we don't know many things about the virus yet, and this is something that we have to work on to try to understand the severity of the virus, the exact transmission mode, and what is the source of this new coronavirus.
It seems to have been a rapid spread recently, a tripling, you know, since the last figures. Do we know what's behind this greater spread?
Well, this is basically really increased surveillance and testing. So more people you test, more cases you will find. This is a new virus from the family of coronaviruses. Coronaviruses normally circulate in the animal world, and then we'll jump to the human population, as it was the case with the SARS in 2002 or Middle East Respiratory Syndrome in 2012. We still don't know how easily it is being transmitted among humans. We know that there is a limited human-to-human transmission, but we don't know really is it easily spread and how exactly it is being transmitted. We don't know how severe it is. So far, there were three deaths, but we understand these were people with underlying health conditions. There were severe illness cases among infected people, but lots of reported cases have also been reported to be a mild cases. We don't know if there are asymptomatic cases yet. And then again, it would be important to know really what is the source. Coronaviruses are coming from animal world, but we should be able to determine exactly what that source is.
Now, you mentioned SARS from about 15, 20 years ago. What lessons have we learned from SARS that could be applied to controlling this new outbreak?
The critical thing is to have a strong health systems. Strong health systems that have equipped and trained health workforce, that have enough of core capacities that are built under international health regulations, basically being able to quickly detect, test, provide medical care to people who are infected, and basically put in place infection prevention and control measures at health facilities, having diagnostic tools, So all of these things that make one health system strong. So that's why it was important, for example, this time that China, in just 9 days, was able to identify this new virus, to share the genetic sequence with WHO and with other countries, which ultimately helped other countries to test travelers. And again, being able really to reassure the population, to say what we know, what we don't know, and provide the general advice on how ordinary people can prevent exposure.
What are the basic precautions that people traveling to the region or people who have been to the region should be taking to avoid this virus?
Really, it is measures that we would recommend for avoiding any respiratory illness. This is basically covering your mouth when you are sneezing and coughing. Regular hand washing, so hand hygiene, avoiding contact with a sick person or person who we think could have a respiratory illness, avoiding contact with unprotected contact with the live animals at the market. And obviously, if you are sick and if you feel that you have a respiratory disease, to seek medical care as soon as possible. So then, hopefully, the health providers will be able to diagnose you quickly and to provide appropriate treatment.
That was Tarek Jasarevic, spokesman for the World Health Organization, speaking to our own Jason Patinkin. Australia on Monday boosted emergency grants and loans for small businesses hit by brush fires that have ravaged the country during the peak tourist season, as firefighters use cooler weather to prepare for return of hazardous fire conditions. The federal government said it would increase grants for small businesses affected by the fires to about $34,000 each, up from about $10,000 announced earlier, and offer loans of up to $500,000 Australian dollars, interest-free for 2 years. Now joining us on the phone from Canberra is James Pearson, the Chief Executive of the Australian Chamber of Commerce. Welcome to the program, James.
Thank you, Steve.
Now, I just read some numbers, some cash figures, but that really doesn't put the tail on the human toll this has been on business members throughout Australia. And as the Chief Executive of the Chamber, I was wondering what you could share with us about what your constituency has been through.
This has been a devastating time for people in small businesses and the communities, the regional communities that they serve. We've also seen, of course, a tragic loss of wildlife. People have lost their lives and their homes. Businesses have been destroyed and entire regions have been affected. We need to recognise, though, that Australians are resilient people. It's in our DNA and we're still very much open for business. And we need to recognise, too, that while these regions have been affected, the rest of our economy has been relatively unscathed, and we expect the impact to be no more than about 1% on economic growth this year.
How fast are the tourist areas looking to rebuild and recover once the brush fires are relatively under control?
Well, let me tell you a story, Steve. Mm-hmm. There's a place called Kangaroo Island off the south of Australia.
Right.
2 weeks ago, it was swept by fire. Last weekend, a cruise ship visited, and the first people to welcome people ashore were the people in small business in Kangaroo Island. They make up that island's economy, and they're the people who are determined to come together and get those businesses, that economy, back on its feet. And they're welcoming tourists as we speak. And that's happening right around the parts of the country which have been affected by the fires. The message from Australia is very clear. As a country and in the affected communities, we're open for business, we're already responding, we're already rebuilding.
We have about 40 seconds left. If we take a look at the grants that are being offered by the Australian government, is that sufficient for some of those in the hardest hit areas?
It's important that those grants get paid out as quickly as possible, and we're encouraging the government to make them easier to get and quicker to get, because we know that the future for small businesses depends on how quickly they can reopen after a natural disaster. And that's what my organization is focusing all of its efforts on right now.
James Pearson is the Chief Executive of the Australian Chamber of Commerce, speaking to us from Canberra. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Steve.
Iran said on Monday that it had not closed the door to negotiations and efforts to resolve a dispute over its nuclear agreement with world powers. Reuters reporter Joe Davies has that story.
The door to negotiations to resolve a dispute over Iran's nuclear agreement with world powers has not closed. That was the message from Iran's foreign ministry spokesman on Monday. Abbas Mousavi said Tehran still remains in the deal, and European leaders' claims about Iran violating it are unfounded. The 2015 nuclear deal secured Tehran's sanctions relief in return for limiting its nuclear work. But Iran has gradually stepped back from its obligations after Washington quit the agreement before imposing stringent US sanctions. President Trump has said he wants a new deal that would cover nuclear issues, Iran's ballistic missile program, and Iranian activities in the Middle East. Earlier this month, Britain, France and Germany, also signatories to the pact, triggered a dispute mechanism, citing Iranian violations. This started a diplomatic process that could lead to UN sanctions being reimposed. The UK government has said a Trump deal could replace the 2015 agreement. American relations with Iran have worsened in recent weeks after the US killed Iran's top military commander, before Iran retaliated with missile attacks on US targets in Iraq. On Monday, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman repeated his country's rejection of a Trump deal. Iranian officials have said Trump couldn't be trusted, so such a deal wouldn't have any value.
That was Reuters' Joe Davies. U.S. President Donald Trump on Monday rejected the Democrat-led House of Representatives impeachment charges and called for their immediate dismissal by the Republican-led Senate in a memo offering a legal and political case against his removal. The 116-page trial memorandum sought to undercut charges that the Republican president abused his power and obstructed Congress and constituted Trump's first comprehensive defense before his Senate trial begins in earnest on Tuesday. Separately, Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell put forward rules that could lead to a quick impeachment trial for Mr. Trump, with no guarantee that witnesses or new evidence would be allowed. Democrats say Trump abused his power by withholding U.S. military assistance to Ukraine and obstructed Congress by refusing to hand over documents and barring administration officials from testifying. Tens of thousands of U.S. gun rights activists from around the country rallied peacefully at the Virginia Capitol on Monday to protest plans by the state's Democratic leadership to pass gun control legislation. It's a move that has become a key flashpoint in the national debate over gun violence. The size of the crowd and the expected participation of white supremacists and fringe militia groups raise fears that the state could see a repeat of the violence that exploded in 2017 in Charlottesville. But the rally concluded uneventfully around noon, and the mood was largely festive, with rallygoers chanting,
"USA! USA! USA! USA!"
and waving signs denouncing Democratic Governor Ralph Northam. VOA's Carolyn Pursuti was at the rally, and I spoke to her earlier.
The first shock was when you first walked out of the parking deck, that everyone on the street had a gun, and it was out in the open. I have never been on any American street in my entire life with so many guns that are readily seen, whether they were in the front of the person, like across their chest, whether they were slung over their shoulder. Others were trying to hide underneath a waistband or in a pocket, but everybody had guns. And they could, you know, it's perfectly legal in Virginia to carry a weapon on the street.
Now, there were some concerns leading up to this rally that bad actors could appear there, and there were some gun bans put in place. Can you discuss that a little bit?
It was almost as if we were witnessing two different types of rallies. The first one was outside on just the general sidewalks of the city of Richmond, but adjacent to the state house, to the state capitol. But in order to get into a penned-in area around the state house, you had to go through a metal detector, and no weapons were allowed inside. Governor Ralph Northam had passed had issued an executive order, an emergency order, that banned all weapons from the Virginia Square, which is a grassy field around the Capitol. So no one who entered that area, who attended the rally, could could have a weapon on them.
The issue of gun control is a hotly debated topic in the United States. There were people there also advocating for more gun control. What was their presence there?
The counter-protesters had planned an event later in the afternoon following the gun rally, and they canceled for fear of violence. So it was very difficult to find any counter-protesters. In fact, I cannot say that I saw one outside on the street, but there were counter-protesters inside the building meeting with legislators, and one group that we know about was a group of students who went inside to quietly meet with Democratic legislators to say, look, we support these laws. We aren't as loud as the people outside, but we support you, so please pass these gun laws. Now, keep in mind, the whole idea of this day is an annual lobbying day at the Richmond Capitol. So many of these gun advocates had already been in to see their House of Delegates member or their state senator to tell them that they didn't support those gun laws. So it's not like the legislators only heard from one side. They literally heard from both sides today.
That was VOA correspondent Carolyn Prasutti speaking to me from Richmond, Virginia. On the eve of the annual World Economic Forum in Davos, focus on teenage activist Greta Thunberg is there as she prepares to challenge the global financial elite to fight global climate change. Reuters' Conway Gittins reports.
Unite behind science. Climate activists and academics are speaking out on the eve of the World Economic Forum in Davos. As global leaders and the business elite start to arrive for Tuesday's official start, climate change is expected to top the agenda. Even the impending arrival of U.S. President Donald Trump isn't hogging all the limelight, partly thanks to the presence of Greta Thunberg.
The teenage climate change activist was supposed to speak here, but her team says she is unwell. But she very well may be putting the finishing touches on planned comments for an opening day summit in which the 17-year-old will once again have the ear of the world's most powerful.
Swedish student Thunberg launched the Fridays for Future movement in 2018, sparking worldwide protests. Last week, the teenager marched with 10,000 environmental protesters in the Swiss city of Lausanne. But WEF founder Klaus Schwab says it's important for other young voices in Davos to be acknowledged, too.
We should not just concentrate on Greta. She has certainly got a kind of celebrity status, but I'm thinking of this young girl whom we have here, who has changed at the age of 19 the whole policy of Indonesia concerning plastics.
Hundreds of protesters are braving the cold to hike 40 kilometers or 25 miles to Davos. Some are dressed as koala bears, a reference to the bushfires that have ravaged their habitat in Australia. Though the government there has been hesitant to make a link to climate change, the fires have deepened public concern about the heating of the planet. Greta and the other young activists here aren't going to let delegates forget it.
That was Reuters reporter Conway Gittins, and you're listening to VOA News.
Rock and roll, America's finest export. Our culture and music of today are permanently indebted to the pioneers who trailblazed this musical tradition. Listen to Border Crossings on February 6th to hear rock's greatest musicians like Jerry Lee Lewis, Buddy Holly, and Elvis Presley, only on The Voice of America.
VOA's Our Voices television program is about more than just sitting and talking about women's issues. It's about listening to them and bringing their opinions to the table and making sure that their voices are heard. Because our lived experiences, our stories, and our voices will help shape the next generation.
Check your local TV listings and join the conversation each week with Our Voices on VOA.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe said Monday that South Korea was its most important neighbor and that the two shared basic values, taking a conciliatory tone towards the country that has been locked in a bitter row with Tokyo for over a year. The comment comes after South Korean President Moon Jae-in last week proposed the two countries work together to resolve the issue of wartime forced laborers and call Japan our closest neighbor. Earlier, I spoke with Grant Newsham, senior research fellow at the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies in Tokyo, and got his reaction to the comments the prime minister made and asked him what he made of their timing.
Abe has always been something of a statesman. You know, he's willing to sort of bite his tongue and sort of make a conciliatory gesture. I think that he sees himself as having very little to lose by sort of offering a little bit of an olive branch to the South Koreans. And, you know, he might get lucky, and the Koreans might respond in kind. But what you're saying, I think the timing's right. They've gone through this recent, really very serious fuss between the two nations, where the Koreans sort of demanded the Japanese do something different, do something more about World War II era labor, the comfort women, etc. They threatened to end the intelligence sharing agreement, and then so the Japanese did not back down. They imposed trade sanctions basically on South Korea. And the South Koreans, I think, did more than they should have done, and I think they recognize that. And Abe really is in no hurry, I think, to reach an agreement with South Korea. But it looks good, and the South Koreans have backed off a bit, so he's reciprocating. And I think it's this dance that's going on. Abe thinks it's his turn to offer a sort of a little gesture to the South Koreans and see how they respond.
Is there anything else that we should be keeping an eye on as the relationship between Seoul and Tokyo continues to change?
I think the real test would be if the two nations' militaries start to actually do something more cooperative than they've ever done in the past. Obviously, it's been pretty icy recently, but look through the military front. See if there's any improvement there. And what you look for is joint exchanges, joint training, or even just modest steps to get together and do military things or talk about military topics. I would also tend to look at the South Korean side and see if the Moon administration makes an effort to rein in the most extreme anti-Japanese parts of sort of that administration's universe, and also rein in the legal attacks which have gone on towards the Japanese, thought they had settled. So I'd look at what the Moon administration does, what it says, what it tries to get its allies to stop doing in terms of pressuring Japan, embarrassing Japan, and look at the military front as well. And obviously something that does get people's attention is the Moon administration's steps to build little better ties with the People's Republic of China. Japan would be watching for that as well. You know, this is something we've seen before. If you follow Japan-Korea relations over the years, they wax and wane. Sometimes they're okay, and then other times they do get acrimonious.
That was senior research fellow at the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies in Tokyo, Grant Newsham, speaking to me on the phone from Taiwan. Paris commuters who were careworn after 6 weeks of misery-inducing transport strikes found their smiles again as some subway workers ended their walkouts over pension system concerns. The AP's Charles de Ledesma reports.
News from the subway wing of the UNSA union of a return to work after 46 consecutive days out has produced a marked improvement in services as the French capital embarks on a new week. One traveller says it's been very fluid, now relieved to be back riding the metro during the morning rush hour again. But not all strikers voted to return to work. Unions have split over whether to accept government compromise proposals or to continue pushing for a complete withdrawal of its plans to reform the pension system. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
The European Union's top diplomat says they must consider all ways to support the fragile truce in Libya. From Reuters News, Adam Reed brings us that story.
The European Union will discuss all ways to uphold the fragile ceasefire in Libya, but any peace settlement will need real EU support to make it stick. That's according to the EU's top diplomat, Josep Borrell. Over the weekend, foreign powers agreed at a summit in Berlin to shore up the shaky truce. The country's been in turmoil since the fall of Muammar Gaddafi in 2011. Borrell on Monday.
There are several possibilities, and the ministers have to decide what to do in order to help to implement the agreements of yesterday's conference.
Asked about whether the EU could consider a military peacekeeping mission, Borrell would only say that a ceasefire requires someone to take care of it and that someone has to monitor and manage it. The EU has military missions around the world, but has struggled to keep a team of experts in Tripoli to support the UN-backed government there due to security concerns. Borrell's comments were also backed up by Finland's foreign minister, who suggested the EU's naval mission off Libya should be restarted. The naval mission was aimed at upholding an arms embargo on Libya and controlling migration across the Mediterranean. It ended last spring after pressure from the Italian government, which was largely controlled by a hard-right anti-migrant party at the time.
That was Reuters' Adam Reed. The Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights is appealing for $375.5 million to support its efforts to promote and protect human rights in dozens of countries around the world at a time of great turbulence and erosion of fundamental rights. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva, where the High Commissioner is based.
Human rights is one of the three main pillars of the United Nations, along with peace and security and development. And yet, the office established to be the world's human rights watchdog is seriously short of cash. Barely half of last year's record $321.5 million appeal was funded. The UN High Commissioner's Office hopes this year's appeal will receive more generous support from the international community. Human rights spokesman Jeremy Lawrence says a great deal of work lies ahead. These include monitoring nations' compliance with human rights law, protecting people with disabilities, promoting gender and women's rights, preventing conflicts, grievances, and discrimination of all kinds.
This year we aim to strengthen efforts in five key frontier areas that are having an increasing impact on fundamental human rights. These are climate change, digital technologies, inequalities, corruption, and people on the move.
Lawrence tells VOA much of the work ahead this year will involve Africa. He says his agency will supply the resources, technical assistance, and other support to help vulnerable areas improve the human rights of their people.
This year we're establishing a new office in Sudan, and we're looking at strengthening our programs in Ethiopia. We also will be looking to enhance the benefit of those countries' political transitions on their economies and societies. And we're also further expanding our work in the Sahel, including through a country office in Niger.
In the Americas, Lawrence says the High Commissioner's Office will reinforce technical cooperation and protection in Venezuela. Another big project, he says, will entail work to calm the situation in Bolivia, which is experiencing instability triggered by the ousting of former President Evo Morales. He says human rights officials will seek to establish a genuine and inclusive dialogue between the government and civil society to defuse the crisis. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And finally, we say goodbye to jazz saxophonist Jimmy Heath. He died at the age of 93 in his home in Loganville, Georgia, according to the New York Times. The AP's music correspondent, Margie Zaraleta, has this look at his career.
Jimmy Heath was nicknamed Little Bird because he was so good at emulating Charlie Parker. Heath played jazz since the 1940s as bebop was taking off. His heroin addiction in the 1950s landed him in prison, where he continued to write music, including most of the material for the Playboys album by Chet Baker and Art Pepper. He recorded with Miles Davis, John Coltrane, and his own family as the Heath Brothers. He was named a jazz master by the National Endowment for the Arts in 2003. I'm Archie Zaraleta.
And that is going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jimmy Cook, thank you very much for spending part of your day with us. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events 24 hours a day. You can also find archived copies of the show on the program page under the live radio tab. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.